Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. Welcome to episode number 18 with a great guest, Leslie Kane. We have all kinds of information on our website, and you're welcome to check it out at podcastufo.com. If you'd like to contact me, info@podcastufo.com. It's a great show today, and I hope you enjoy it. Author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, Leslie Kane on Skype. How are you doing, Leslie?
Doing well, Martin. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm thrilled that you're on, and you call yourself a UFO agnostic. I like that, and it gives you a great sense of integrity while you're doing your researching and writing. Can you tell the listener who may not know your story, how as a journalist you got involved in the UFO phenomena?
Sure, because I never expected to get involved. So what happened was back in 1999, I was working at a public radio station in the San Francisco Bay Area, producing and co-hosting a daily investigative news program there. And a colleague in France sent me this extraordinary report written by high-level military people in that country. And it was an English translation of this 90-page study that was eventually going to be released in the States, but he gave me kind of an advanced copy of it. And what it was a three-year study performed by, among the group were four generals, an admiral, the former head of the National Space Study Center in France, which is the equivalent of NASA in this country, some scientists, some engineers, these very, very sophisticated, knowledgeable, and high-level people had focused on this issue for a number of years. And they issued a report because they were concerned about the national security implications, the defense implications of these things that were being seen by pilots and aviation people around the world. And they studied only the official cases that they, in the most official and the best cases, the cases for which we have so much evidence that you really can't find a conventional explanation for anything. So, at least for the cases they studied. So, I received this report and I was just very, very struck by the conclusion, not only the cases presented, but the conclusions of these high-level people, which was that the phenomenon in the cases they studied, which again are the cases with the best evidence, officially investigated, the phenomenon in the best explanation that they could come up with for those cases was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And they said this was the most valid, the most likely explanation for these objects that were being seen. And I thought, as a journalist then, just sort of looking for a good story, I thought when you have generals and admirals saying that it's very likely that we are being visited by extraterrestrial craft of some sort, I thought this was a big news story. I mean, imagine if the equivalent officials in America came out with a statement like that. It would be a huge thing. So I was very struck by the power of their conclusion, and the writing in this report was also very, very strong and powerful and interesting. And that's what got me started. I wanted to look into it based on their conclusions, and I wrote a story for the Boston Globe based on this French report, which is known as the Cometa Report. And that story came out in the spring of 2000. And that's how I got started. And ever since then, I've been pretty much primarily focused on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've done some great work. And I'd love to say that I'm finished your book. I'm in the middle of it. It's a great book. And I highly recommend our listeners to check the book out. Also, there's some videos up on YouTube that I've seen. What's the name of the movie that's up there?
You mean that I'm involved with?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, there was you may be thinking of the one that was aired on the History Channel last summer, which was called UFOs on the Record.
That's it yes.
Yeah, it was based on my book, basically, and I worked as a producer with an independent production company to create that film, and then it was commissioned by the History Channel, basically.
Uh huh.
So that might be the one you're thinking of.
Yes, it is, yes. So before we talk more about your book, I have a few other questions for you. Basically, the facts and evidence point to something in our skies, which, as you mentioned, way beyond our technological capabilities. What are your thoughts? Do you go along with the hypothesis?
The hypothesis that they may be extraterrestrial. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's a valid hypothesis. I don't think anyone who studies the evidence can argue with that. Again, it's an hypothesis, though, which means a theory. It's not proven. Mm-hmm. So what we're stuck with is a compelling body of data that suggests something that is not man-made and that is technological, as you said. So what do you do with that data? And you have to think about, well, maybe it could be X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, the leading hypothesis seems to be the extraterrestrial one, that this is some kind of a vehicle from another planet somewhere. There's also a possible hypothesis that had been put forward that it might be from another dimension, or it could be time travelers. I mean, mm-hmm. people have a lot of ideas about it, and it's possible that every single one of these, I mean, there's always the remote possibility, you can't rule it out 100%, that every one of these cases has some kind of conventional explanation. But that's such a minute chance, because the ones that I feature in my book, and some of them are the same ones that were in the French report, have been so thoroughly investigated, and there's so much data involved with these cases that you really can eliminate all conventional explanations. It's possible to do that in some of these cases. And then you're stuck with the data. So, yes, obviously I'm going to honor the extraterrestrial hypothesis, as do many of the officials that have written chapters from my book and have investigated these, including five generals that I've interviewed and have written for my book. They would agree with that it's a valid hypothesis, that we have no choice but to consider it. But, you know, it shakes up all the paradigms that we know. The scientists don't think it's possible. But then again, we're stuck with the data. And but when you said earlier that I'm an agnostic, what I mean by that is that I'm agnostic as to what the UFOs actually are, because science has not been able to prove yet for us what they are. Are they extraterrestrial? Are they time travelers? Are they something? Are some of the cases perhaps something man-made and highly secret technology? I mean, we have to look at the fact that we really don't know. And I think one of the problems we have is that many people assume that a UFO is by definition something extraterrestrial, and it's not. And that's a very important distinction that I feel I make throughout my book, and I think is extremely important for people to understand. We're dealing with an unknown physical phenomenon, but we don't know what it is yet.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of people will go to the extreme one way or the other, you know.
Absolutely. Yep.
Now, the Mars rover Curiosity has recently landed as we're recording this podcast, and it's sending back images currently. Luckily, it landed safely. So we're out there exploring another planet in our solar system, which is very, very young compared to other solar systems out there. Why do you suppose that it's so difficult for the scientific community to explore the possibility that we may be visited by civilizations that could be millions of years advanced of us?
Well, it's a really, really great question, Martin. I mean, there are some scientists who do consider that question, such as Michio Kaku, the famous mm-hmm. physicist who talks about it all the time. And Brian Greene, also the physicist from Columbia who's done shows for NOVA, is also sort of open to all kinds of possibilities that are suggested by the cutting-edge physics that we are now dealing with, and string theory and all the new ideas that these physicists have about the cosmos. Certainly, they open the door to the possibility of, you know, advanced civilizations being able to learn how to travel through vast distances. So it seems logical. I agree with you that it seems logical. If you're dealing with a civilization that's a million years advanced from us, they are going to know how to do the kinds of things that we can't even imagine are possible. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of scientists are just sort of, they're so wedded to the thinking that they have spent years developing and studying, and their whole careers are tied in with the way they think and look at the universe. And they're just sort of set in their ways. I think the other problem is the ridicule factor is a big problem. Mm-hmm. Scientists feel they can't even look at this because it's too risky for their careers, unfortunately, because of the negative attitudes that exist in our culture towards doing so. And they're not going to get grant money if they start playing around with UFOs. This is a big barrier, because some of them are interested on a personal level, but on a professional level, they feel it's way too risky to get involved with it. And I think a third problem is that there isn't enough what they consider to be hard data to work with. I mean, there's interesting cases, but they don't have some physical material that they can take into a lab and study, which is the way they're used to working on things. They have to develop a new methodology here. They have to my theory, what I would suggest if I was, you know, telling the scientists what to do would be to form an international coalition and to develop a methodology by which they could study sightings that are going on all the time, whether it be setting up radar stations or new kinds of cameras or whatever. They have to kind of get proactive and find a way to study the phenomenon that's different, because just looking at the cases that we already have isn't going to solve the mystery of what they actually are. That's what we need. Mm-hmm. So scientists have to decide they want to do that, and you know, and then they can do it. I believe that we have brilliant scientists that can do whatever they set out to do, but they haven't set out to do it for the reasons I've stated. And you know, so we have a big problem here, which is, as you point out, that scientists aren't more open to it. They may entertain the possibility that advanced civilizations can do a lot of things we can't imagine, but actually getting down and studying UFOs is a whole other order of magnitude for them.
I hope we see a day when this changes and this is really taken serious and studied properly, because it would be the greatest answer of the millennia, or of all time, I believe.
I agree. I think it's one of the most interesting and most significant questions facing it's facing civilization here on the planet. Are we alone? I mean, that's a very, very big question. And I think if we found out we were not, it could have huge ramifications for, hopefully for the better, mm-hmm. in terms of unifying the planet and giving us a different perspective on our, where we fit in the universe, that we're not the only species around. But we don't know. There's all kinds of possible scenarios that it could be dangerous, that, you know, that people have proposed that if they're much more advanced than us, of course, they would have complete control over us. So who knows what to make of the whole thing, but I think it's important to know the truth, regardless of its implications. And so when we have this recurring phenomenon that science completely ignores, we're just delaying the discovery of what it actually is, which is inevitable at some point that we're going to find out, as far as I see it.
You know, the conversation leads me to think about the possibility of government cover-up, and that the government or a part of the government may know that this already exists, yet billions of dollars are spent, for instance, on the rover and other science exploration, the Kepler, and looking for life out there. And what if there is a part of the government that already knows there is?
It's a good question, and I think we don't have the answer as to, definitive answer, obviously, as to whether that knowledge is there or not, because it's a secret, therefore we don't know it if it's there. I think that regardless of what we know or don't know, I think the Kepler and the rover and all the exploration we're doing is completely valid and should continue. You can't just sort of drop that because of this other thing. But the question of whether there is some kind of a cover-up within some tight group of people who control this information is one that's really, really hard to answer. I think a lot of it boils down to the question of the Roswell case. And if indeed there was an alien craft that crashed in Roswell, then there is a cover-up. I mean, it's that simple, because if that was alien, we know that it was retrieved, and we know that it's somewhere buried within the government. And if Roswell was not an alien craft, then I think it's an open question as to how much our government knows. But it's quite possible that there is a secret project. I've talked to people who I trust who have told me that there is such a project. I've also heard very compelling arguments from very intelligent investigators that would argue why there isn't one. So, and I've sort of explored both of those scenarios in my book, in one of the chapters in my book. So I think we're sort of stuck without knowing much about it at this point, but there's evidence pointing in all kinds of different directions in terms of what the government knows and doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. So, but the bottom line, as far as I see it, is that even if there is this small secret group that knows something, the vast majority of government officials don't know about it. I mean, you could say just about all of them don't. So the only choice we have is to proceed as if we don't have that knowledge, because it's not being provided to us. So therefore, we need to proceed along a track, assuming that we don't, so that it can be discovered and provided for everybody, and it can be done in a public way to actually make these discoveries. That's the way we have to go, because we don't have access to that information.
That's a very, very good point. I appreciate you putting that to light. A couple of questions I have about skeptics. Do you consider any skeptic out there that you know of doing any major research into this evidence that you've gone through?
Well, it depends how you define major research. I don't think most of the skeptics spend time doing the level of research that the government officials have done, that I've cited in my book or who have written for my book, where they've thoroughly dug into a case and done all the interviews with witnesses, etc. In fact, there are many skeptics, or debunkers is the word I really like to use. I think you're talking more about debunkers, the ones that actually have their mind. Yeah. I mean, there is a difference between a skeptic and a debunker, and I think skepticism is healthy, and I define what genuine skepticism really means in my book, and I think we all need to be circumspect and skeptical in a healthy way. But when you come to debunkers who've really just decided that this can't possibly be, and they're going to provide any answer they can possibly come up with to debunk various UFO cases, I've been told that they don't do interviews with witnesses. They will form an opinion on a case without interviewing one witness. This happens over and over again. Mm-hmm. So, major research, I think some of them, I have great respect for Seth Shostak, who I think does really know something about the subject and has looked into some of the cases more than many of the others have anyway. So, but I think most of them don't take the time, because they're on a mission to just come up with whatever explanation they can to get rid of a case. And that's what they do. But what's interesting, though, is that as a result of my book, I have received many letters, emails from skeptics whose minds have been changed as a result of reading the book, and that's given me a lot of satisfaction.
Wow, that's really nice to hear. I was going to ask you if you've had, what are some other feedback from skeptics that you had about your book?
Well, I mean, a number of them who are just individual people, let's say from a university or something, they're not skeptics that have been out there publicly, but they're people who have written me and said, I've never taken this seriously, I've never thought anything of it, and when I read your book, I've been completely transformed now because of the book. And, of course, that's satisfying to me. But I think one story, this might be of interest to your readers, one of the more famous people that has been affected by the book, and I want to make the point, Martin, that this book, 50% of this book was actually written by other people mm-hmm. than myself, which I think is why a lot of its power is, that I invited these officials, these generals, pilots, and government officials to write their own chapters for my book. So you're hearing directly from them. It's not just all myself. So that's why I feel a little bit more comfortable talking about the power of the book. I'm not just sort of trying to promote myself, but there are about 15 others that have contributed to this book along with me. So back to the story of the skeptics, Derek Pitts is a fairly well-known skeptic. He's the chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, which is a mm-hmm. well-known museum in Philadelphia. And he used to go on television all the time debunking UFO cases. He was on MSNBC a lot. He was sort of one of the scientists that they called on for whenever there was a scientific event. He would be called on to comment, and so he was also called on to comment about UFO events, among everything else. And I was so shocked when I saw him years ago commenting on the O'Hare incident. We can talk about that later, but he was a total debunker. So he's an example of somebody who has been absolutely transformed by the book, to the extent that he invited me to come to the Franklin Institute and give a talk about it.
Wow.
And when I was invited by him, I thought, he said he wanted to have a public conversation with me and discuss the book, right? So I immediately thought, oh, my God. Yeah, I thought, he's a debunker. He's going to want to get me up there on a stage and debunk everything and have a battle with me. And I said to him, if you want me to come give this talk,
I only ask one thing of you, and that is that you promise me you will read the whole book, every page of it, before I get there. And I said, all I ask of people is that they read it, and then they can have any opinion that they want. And he promised he would read it, and he did. And he was completely transformed by this book. And he got up on the stage with me and praised the book up the wazoo and kept asking the question, I don't understand why scientists don't take this seriously.
Wow.
Look at what we've got. And so he was a man that was, just by reading this book, you know, was transformed in his approach to the subject. And I think I admire him for reading it, because I think a lot of the issue is with the skeptics that they won't read things like this. They just avoid them. And I think it's impossible for anybody to read this book because of the chapters written by these authorities from around the world. I don't think people can read this book. Anyone can, and come away from it and still feel like they can debunk every single case. It's just an impossibility. You can't do it. So I think most skeptics won't want to read something like this. And the ones that do are really changed by it, and with Derek Pitts being an example. He even wrote a blurb for the paperback edition, which came out, you know, a year later after the hardback. He wrote a blurb for the book praising it, and is right here in the inside cover of my book. So that's just an example of one person who I'm very happy about that has taken the book seriously and really changed because of it.
That is really great. I'm really glad to hear that someone of that stature, and I know who you're talking about as well, actually come around like that. That's great.
It is really
shows,
great.
Shows that some people do have a mind open enough to deal with this.
Absolutely. And I think he's always had an open mind, but I can tell you, when I saw him talking about O'Hare, and that was only in 2007, it was, mm-hmm. wasn't that long ago before he read the book, maybe 4 years before he read it, he was just laughing and accusing the pilots of being drunk. I mean, he was absolutely so much of a debunker that obviously hadn't looked into any of the evidence for this particular event, that it was just shocking to me. And I even kept a record of it, because when I wrote a paper for the International UFO Reporter, the journal from the UFO Center, the Center for UFO Studies, and, you know, the Hynek organization, mm-hmm. I wrote this long piece about the O'Hare case, which I studied in some detail, and kept it because I wanted to quote him as an example of how these debunkers operate. And there was Derek Pitts' quote. And then who would have ever thought that years later he would have invited me to give a talk and praise my book, you know, like he did. I never would have expected that. But it happened, so it gives us hope.
That's right. Now, was he the person that was claiming that it was a cloud formation or phenomena weather situation?
Actually, that was the FAA. I don't think he ever studied the case enough to claim that. I mean, he just was just being totally flippant about it. Mm-hmm. And no, that was the FAA that got into that, and which I think I dealt with very well in my own investigation. Put that one to bed.
Yes. So I do want to talk about your book in general, but while we're on the O'Hare case, a question that comes to mind on that, was there anyone that you talked to off the record?
There were witnesses, yes, and there were witnesses, I think, well, certainly the names were off the record. What's one thing that's interesting about that case is that not one witness was willing to go on the record with their name.
Yes.
And there were probably 13, 14, 15 of them that eventually spoke to various investigators, mainly Dr. Richard Haynes from NARCAP, who did a thorough study of it. But I think that's very telling that you have a case of this that was covered in the national media and was very, very significant case involving an aviation safety issue, really.
Sure.
And not one witness was willing to put their name on the record because they were afraid for their jobs. And that's just such a telling situation, because it shows the problem that we face here in this country, where witnesses are so afraid to be public about it because of the repercussions that they face. They should not be facing any repercussions for reporting what they're seeing over a major airport at Russia or something that's dangerous. So it's just a completely irrational problem, and it's not like this in other countries where these things are reported much more easily without a lot of repercussions. So I'm glad you raised that point. And yes, I did speak to a couple of witnesses I think, as I recall, one of them allowed me to quote him without his name, but it was extremely delicate, and I had to get the quote approved, and lots of stuff that he told me I could not quote. So there was some off-the-record stuff, mainly with, and I think that's true for all the investigators that talked to the witnesses. They were the ones that were so concerned about going on the record.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was just a simple disc just hoovering over a gate, steady for so many minutes, is that right? And then all of a sudden it shot straight up?
That's exactly right. It was a kind of metallic-looking disc-shaped object that was hovering over a specific gate, gate C-17 at the United Airlines terminal at O'Hare Airport. It was rush hour, just a normal day. The weather was normal, slight drizzle, but, you know, nothing abnormal going on. And it was witnessed by many aviation people, including pilots from the ground, just sort of sitting up there for at least 5 minutes. It might have been longer. And then, as you said, there was a cloud bank, a thick cloud bank above where the object was hovering. It was about 1,800 feet up. Suddenly, the object just shot straight up, literally straight up through that cloud bank and cut a very clear hole in it, as if someone had taken a cookie cutter from above the cloud bank and just, you know, cut this crisp hole in it with a clear outline. And people describe being able to see the blue sky through the hole on the other side of the cloud bank. So there's nothing we know of in our technology that can do that. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. This is what was reported, and many of the witnesses were concerned about the aviation safety implications of when you have something hovering over a major airport at rush hour that doesn't have a transponder, that can't be communicated with, you don't know why it's there, what it is, how long it's going to stay, what it's going to do next. All these very, very significant questions that arise when something like this happens. And the FAA was not interested in it. They didn't investigate. They didn't address it. They only provided ridiculous, phony explanations for it when they were forced to. And that's how these events are handled in this country. And I think this case is so important because it illustrates the problem that we have here so dramatically, not only with witnesses being afraid to talk about it, but with the non-interest and the non-engagement that goes on within our government, the fact that we don't investigate and we don't provide any explanation or even statement to the witnesses and to the general public who are very concerned about something like this. They don't get any response, even a statement saying, we can't explain what this was. That's all we're really asking for from our government. We don't even get that. We just get silly explanations that can be dismissed if you look into the facts of the case, which is what I and others did. Mm-hmm. There were two or three different explanations that were provided, and none of them were even possibilities for what actually happened. So,
right. Now, when you decided to write this book, was there any case out there that you wanted to add to this book, but you couldn't get cooperation?
No, that really didn't happen. There was one potential contributor who was a general from Russia who had told me that he did want to write something for the book, but never did for whatever reasons, I don't know. But mm-hmm. in terms of actual cases, and really I was very, very fortunate to get the people who I invited to contribute. They were all willing to do it. And I think it's partly because I had spent many years developing connections and with these people. So I knew most of them and had met many of them. And so they trusted me enough to be willing to do this. And they worked very hard on the chapters that they wrote. I was extremely grateful for that. And I just think hearing about something in a detailed chapter in the words of the actual person involved is so much more powerful than hearing me tell the story and quoting somebody, which is what that's all you can do in a short article that you might write for a magazine or a newspaper, which is what I'd done previously. And I realized that it's not going to do the job. But these people, we need more detail because the subject is so complicated and controversial. And I thought, what is better than asking these people to tell their stories in their own words? So that's what the book does.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind just going through each case and just a real quick one or two line synopsis of the chapters in your book?
Sure, and I won't be able to cover each case because some of the writers, including myself, include cases within a broader, a bigger chapter. So there's actually a lot of cases that are touched upon. But some of the major ones where there's whole chapters about them are the Belgian Wave from 1989-1990, mm-hmm. which, and that chapter was written by Major General Wilfred de Brouwer, who was the head investigator for the Air Force at the time of the event. And Dr. Richard Haynes from NARCAP, a former NASA senior scientist, wrote a chapter about aviation safety cases, which covers a number of fascinating cases, including the Valentic case from Australia. And then I have Captain Julio Miguel Guerra, who's now a pilot for Portugal, the leading airline in Portugal. He wrote a chapter about an event, his experience of encountering a UFO for over 20 minutes that kind of did elliptical loops around his airplane while another plane was watching. That event occurred in the 1980s, I believe, and he's written a chapter about it. And then the O'Hare Airport case, I wrote a chapter about that because I did a lot of work on that case. The English Channel case of 2007 by Captain Ray Bollier. He was a pilot for a small airline, and he witnessed two gigantic UFOs in 2007 along with his passengers, and that event was also picked up on radar. So, I mean, there's many, many others. I can go on and on. The famous case in Iran, written by General Parviz Jafari in 1976, the dogfight case, he wrote about his own experience in that case. And Oscar Santa Maria from Peru also wrote about his experience trying to shoot down a UFO over an Air Force base in Peru in 1980. It's fascinating to read that. Because you're hearing about, from these guys, you're hearing not only what actually happened, but you get their reactions to it. Were they afraid? How did they respond when they had these close encounters? Why did they try to shoot them down? My job as a sort of an editor for them was to work with them, to draw out from them what their emotional responses were, as well as the actual storytelling, the narrative of what actually happened. And I found that to be the most interesting aspect. And I knew that would be what would be interesting to the readers is, you know, the more personal side of their stories. And military guys don't normally talk about those aspects of a story. So I was, because I knew these guys, I was able to kind of work with them and get them, draw out that side of the story, which I think makes them a lot more interesting because they get so personal in their reactions. And then Rendlesham Forest case is also included in the book. I have pieces both by Sergeant James Peniston and Colonel Charles Holt, which are fascinating. Mm-hmm. Cases out of Chile, cases out of Brazil that are very compelling, written by a general from that country. And John Callahan wrote a chapter about the event over Alaska that's quite well known at this point, in which he was involved with, which has radar, a gigantic kind of almond-shaped object seen by Japanese pilots. And the story of Fife Symington is also a very interesting one, and he's written a short piece for the book about why he initially ridiculed the subject at a press conference and why he's changed his position today and what he thinks should happen in terms of government policy. So those are just some of the cases. Nick Pope has also written a chapter about many cases in the UK, and the French head of the agency there, of JPON, for 20 years, Jean-Jacques Velasco, has written a very interesting chapter about some of the cases from France that are the most compelling cases that he was directly involved with. So that's just a taste of mm-hmm. some highlights of the book.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Thank you.
In your opinion, is there one that stands out as the most compelling case to you?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. I would say that the Belgian Wave I find extremely compelling partly because it happened repeatedly. You know, most UFO cases occur once. These objects that kept returning to Belgium, I find that so fascinating because the Belgians were able to collect so much data. I've been over there, and they have 25 gigantic notebooks full of hard copy reports that were filed on this case, drawings, descriptions, interviews with witnesses and with investigators. Many police officers were involved. Military people saw the objects. And they kept recurring so that the government actually became proactive. The Air Force sent up F-16s, developed a whole protocol by which what was needed before they were, would send up the F-16s. Certain things were needed to, you know, to establish that something was actually there. So they really got into trying to identify what these objects were, because they were invading, sort of, you know, intruding into protected airspace with impunity, and nobody could do anything about it. And so the Air Force, of course, was concerned about that. So I think it's fascinating. I mean, that case, I learned a lot about that case in writing the book. And when I was working with the production company for the History Channel piece, was able to go over there and meet some of the people who I had not met yet and who were actually involved with it, some of the police officers and the pilot from the F-16 who was sent up to take a closer look at it at one point. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely compelling because of the repetition in that case and the volume of evidence that's been collected on it, and the fact that General de Brouwer is such an authority on it and is willing to speak it out about it, and was so meticulous in his studies of the case. So it's really a strong one, and I find it extremely interesting. But so are a lot of the other cases, so it's hard to pick one.
That's right, yes. I agree with that. You mentioned Rendlesham Force. That's another one for me that I think is pretty solid.
I think it's very, very solid. I would absolutely agree with you. It has a lot of physical evidence, which is so important. And radiation readings documented by the MOD, and physical marks on the ground when the craft landed, and many, many witnesses to, and Colonel Holt's tape recording, of course, which people would listen to, which involved his immediate real-time observations along with a whole group of other people who were seeing the same things, very extraordinary things that happened there.
That's right. That's an amazing story right there. You mentioned the former Arizona governor, Fife Symington, and he came forward and set the record straight. And Larry King had a wonderful series talking about this seriously. And you would think that would be enough for the mainstream media to be all over this. Why do you suppose the mainstream media, is it ridicule? Why they stay away?
Well, it's interesting, Martin, because the mainstream media has a very short attention span. I think this is one of the problems. Now, when Fife Symington originally came out with his acknowledgement that he had actually been a witness to that UFO back in 1997, and I was the person that broke that story, I had exclusive access to him. I wrote a story about it for a small paper in Arizona. Well, the mainstream media was all over it. I mean, they did cover that story. They all wanted interviews with him. He would not provide interviews with a lot of them because he just didn't want to do this. But it was a big, big story, and it was covered by CNN. But what happens is the mainstream will get on these stories, and then they just forget about them. They don't pursue, they don't follow up and dig deeper and maybe try to look into other cases that might have happened, you know, that could be similar. Or they just do a one-shot thing, and then there is something else. So I think that's the way they work, which is what we need are investigative journalists that will take months to dig into a case and then do a story about it. But they don't do it that way. That's the problem.
Yeah, then you're right. They're very ephemeral. Everything is right at the moment, or it's old news.
And they do cover things, though. The O'Hare case also was a major media story. You know, CNN and other stations covered it. It was the front page in the Chicago Tribune. Got a huge number of hits on the website. But then it's over. In a day or two, that's it. It's gone. Mm-hmm. They just don't stay with anything. And that's why I think I play a particular role here in being a journalist who has actually stayed with this topic and really dug into it for years and years and years. I don't know of any other journalist that's even done it for months. Other researchers have, but not journalists. So it's just the way the media operates. They're assigned a story by their bosses. They go out and cover the story for a day or two, and then they're assigned something else, and that's it.
Well, I hope I'm speaking for a lot of people out there. I really appreciate what you're doing. We're just about out of time, and another question, just one more question I have for you. Since you've written this book, have you been researching any new credible accounts? And if so, can you talk about it?
Yeah, I have actually been researching some cases from the country of Chile, which I've become very interested in. I've written two stories in last spring on the El Bosque videos that were taken at the place. It's called the El Bosque Air Force Base, which is in Santiago, Chile. And there were some extraordinary videos taken there during an air show in which some kind of an object flew by these airplanes that were flying over the base as a part of a ceremony. And this case really intrigued me. Did two pieces on it. A lot of the debunkers said that they thought the image was a bug. So it's not completely clear. I don't know if it can be proven what the objects were, or it, we can't even determine that much about them. But I'm about to write another story to kind of try to lay this case to rest, although we're not going to have a definitive answer to the case. But further studies have been done on it since I wrote the initial story, and I've actually been to Chile and have met with people from the agency there, and I'm very interested in not only the cases that they have, and the one this one I'm mentioning is just one of many really interesting cases, but also the way they operate it in Chile. The government agency there has 4 full-time staff people that do nothing but look into these cases. And it's very, very impressive what they've been able to do, and the way that the whole country, that all the official branches, the military, the aviation community, the radar controllers, the pilots, everybody is plugged into the system in which reports are filed immediately with this agency when anything happens.
Wow.
And yeah, it's very, very impressive, and I think it serves as a model for the rest of the world in terms of how governments should handle this issue and the way it can work effectively within a country. So I'm interested in trying to learn more about how they operate and eventually bringing back some of that information to the states and trying to use it to influence our own government as sort of a model for how things can actually work. So I that's sort of been a focus of mine since in the last 6 months or so has been the situation in Chile.
Wow, great. Well, you've been absolutely spectacular. Thank you so much. And your website is ufosontherecord.com, is that right?
That's right, yes, and there's a link there if you want to buy the book. It's out in paperback, so it's not expensive. And also, I'm very active on my Facebook page if people want to go there and write a comment or a question or anything like that. That's great, too.
Yes, that's actually how I got in touch with you.
Yeah, so, and that's I mean, I've been a little bit off it a little bit more than usual because I've been away with family for the month of July, but I'm sort of getting back in the groove now. So I hope to hear from people. And thanks very much, Martin, for doing the interview. I really appreciate it.
Yes. So this is Martin Willis with Leslie Kane, and that's it for today.